This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota. And today we're going to start our show talking about some history that's being remembered right now. It's the Great Western Trail, and we're going to talk about the trail's progress around North Dakota with the project manager, Daryl Dorgan. Daryl, always a pleasure to talk to you.
And it's always a pleasure to be back on Prairie Public.
Daryl, you and former NDSU President Jim Osborne are heading up this effort in the state. How did all this get started?
Well, as you know, about 20 years ago, I left Prairie Public Television and started a video production company. And then a group came to me and said, hey, we want to build a Cowboy Hall of Fame. Will you take over that project? And I come from southwestern North Dakota, grew up with horses. We had racehorses and cattle. It's history. And so I said, sure, I'll do that. And got the Cowboy Hall of Fame done about 7 or 8 years ago. Jim Osborne was a member of the Cowboy Hall of Fame. His maternal grandfather had come up the Great Western Trail all the way from Texas to North Dakota in the 1890s. He had put one of the obelisk markers at the Cowboy Hall of Fame to mark it. That was the only one in North Dakota at the time. And we had a little ceremony. Later on, I got it done and got the Cowboy Hall of Fame done, and we dedicated it. I went on to other things, making documentaries. But the people down in Texas and Oklahoma who are heading this project kept calling me and saying, hey, will you take this project on? Will you do it? Will you do it? Will you do it? Finally, last year, I said, okay, I will do it, provided you can get Jim Osborne to get involved in it.
Yeah.
They called Jim Osborne and twisted his arm, and the two of us got together and we're getting it done. We are marking it all the way from South Dakota to Canada. This trail was already marked in Texas, Oklahoma. It goes through 8 states, close to 3,000 miles, and it's where North Dakota's first industry began.
Well, give us that brief history here about what was the Great Western Trail. What was its importance?
Well, the Great Western Trail began right after the Civil War in the 1870s. There were millions of cattle running loose in Texas and perhaps part of Oklahoma, and they had to do something with them. And actually, from all the way from Mexico, Matamoros, Mexico is where it began. Trade wars then, trade wars today, you know. So they started driving them north. Initially, they went to Kansas City because that's where they could hit the railhead. And they would spread out all along the way. Some cattle would get dropped off. Some would go north, and then they'd get dropped off further north. But Kansas City was kind of the railhead, and they would go from there to Chicago, New York, and they would be sold. And eventually that trail led through 8 states all the way to North Dakota. And it's estimated that between 8 and 9 million head of cattle came from Texas up that trail. I don't know how many came into North Dakota and then even into Canada, but the number was considerable. They came all the way to Fort Buford, North Dakota, which is where our distribution was, a key distribution point was. And that lasted for about 20 years. So that's kind of the thumbnail history of it. These kids would get on and hire on as drovers in Texas, get on these horses and ride them and bring 2,000-3,000 head of cattle at a time. Remember back, if you will, years ago when both Doug Hamilton and Daryl Dorgan were quite a bit younger, there were programs on television about cattle drives starring Clint Eastwood. Programs like that. Well, that's what happened. They brought them all the way north. You know, it took them a long time. They might be able to make 10 miles a day. They made $30 a month. Stopped in Dodge City and other places along the route. Made it all the way into North Dakota. It basically kind of parallels Highway 85. Some went west from there over to Medora, then Miles City. And, you know, you always see the pictures when you see Western movies of the saloon in Dodge City, Kansas. You know, the famous saloon where Matt Dillon and Miss Kitty hung out. And we had that in North Dakota, too, by the way. Big Mouth Bob's Bug Juice Dispensary. That was the name of the big saloon in Medora, North Dakota, that the drovers would have hung out in. So, and incidentally, the slogan of the saloon in Medora, Big Mouth Bob's Bug Juice Dispensary, was, "It only takes two." So they came all the way north, but it took them months to make that trip. But I know of one particular case where a young man beginning at the age of 13 made that trip from Texas all the way to North Dakota three times, and his family still lives here.
Wow. So how was it created? I've seen documentaries about the Transcontinental Railroad, and they had to survey land that had never been really visited before, at least by settlers and European people. So how was the trail set? Who were the trailblazers? Did it meander? There were rivers. There were geographical complications. Was it largely a path created by cattle, or were there little signposts along the way?
No signposts. You simply headed north and had a scout out in front of you looking for the easiest way and where there was water. You kept heading north, and yeah, there were deviations. You know, you would maybe stop in Wyoming. There were a couple different places, and that's how you got the cattle into Wyoming. Nebraska's the same way. Kansas is the same way.
Was the trail one way, or was it a route south to bring cattle to meat packing and transportation hubs, you know, to meet the railroad, for example?
No, it was basically a one-way trail, and it came north, dropped cattle off at various locations all the way up that trail, and then those cattle were ranched in Nebraska, Wyoming, Colorado, Kansas, Montana Territory, North Dakota, and various packing plants opened along the way, and railroads eventually came, and they were shipped to other packing plants. For instance, the Marquis de Moore came to North Dakota and opened up a packing plant. Didn't last long, but we had one there. And so that happened all the way up the trail. A lot of that beef went into Chicago. The Marquis de Moore had a slaughterhouse in Medora, North Dakota, slaughtered cattle there that had come up the trail, and they were packed in ice. They would work all winter cutting ice out of the Little Missouri, and he had ice houses established every 100 or 200 miles, Dickinson, Bismarck, Jamestown, that kind of thing. And they would keep those cars packed with ice, ship them all the way to Chicago, in fact, New York, and sell the beef there.
Daryl Dorgan is the project manager of the Great Western Trail in North Dakota. Daryl, I assume this is how certain kinds of workers got to be known as cowboys. I'm also wondering whether the breed of cattle at that time, before all these other breeds existed, was largely longhorn or something like that.
They were longhorns, and there are incredible. There are still a couple people who would raise them basically as a hobby, but I've seen longhorns out in the Badlands. A good friend of mine who has since passed away, George Hagee, raised longhorns, and some of these would have horns from tip to tip that would be 6 feet long. And if you're in a pen with a longhorn trying to do a little sorting or something like that, just a little flick of the head, you can give you a pretty good cut. And so they were very difficult to handle. They were very wild. Most of them, when they were leaving Mexico and Texas, really had no interaction at all with cowboys, horses, that kind of thing. And of course, there was a continuing war between Native Americans who claimed, rightfully so, the land between Texas and North Dakota and the adjoining states, theirs by treaty. I mean, in North Dakota, for instance, we actually were governed by the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, which was subsequently changed to the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. And that would have been the same as South Dakota and parts of Wyoming. So of course, there were constant fights over that. People got killed bringing those cattle up here. But it evolved, other people came in from other countries and moved to North Dakota under the Homestead Act, claimed 160 acres or a ranch, open range in the Badlands. And they bought those cattle and raised longhorn cattle and took them to market. And it truly is North Dakota's first industry.
Well, where those cattle went occasionally had a lot of buffalo in it, too. Was there beefalo as a result 100-some years ago?
Wasn't supposed to be, but there is, and there's still beefalo today. We did a documentary on beefalo and buffalo about 2 years ago, and a lot of buffalo do have a certain amount of cattle genes in. Although, interestingly enough, they test all the time, and they're trying to keep that from happening. And a lot of buffalo ranchers are selecting those cattle or buffalo that have strictly buffalo genes in them, and eliminating those that have any type of cattle gene in. So yeah, there were beefalo, but we're kind of getting rid of them a little bit.
You're mentioning that the part of the trail that was in North Dakota roughly approximates the route of Highway 85 now. Does that indicate that the trailblazers were pretty good at finding ways to connect point A and point B?
Oh yeah, you had a guy out in front of you. First of all, you had probably if you were running 3,000 head of cattle, you probably had 15 cowboys, and then you had a chuck wagon, pulled chuck wagon, and you had some extra gear in there, and it had cooking gear, and then you had an outrider who was always riding ahead of you, and he might be 10, 15 miles ahead of you, and he was always looking for water and the easiest way through the hills. And so a lot of these, it wasn't like a highway. They weren't all the same. They kind of spread out, looking for the easiest way. Maybe they went over into a certain segment towards the Little Missouri River as they were heading north. Or if we were having a wet year in North Dakota, you could have stayed in that area that was near the Highway 85 trail or the highway, because there would have been water over in that area too. So you were always looking for the easiest way to get around. There are spots where you can still spot in different states, and I think there's at least one in North Dakota down by Bowman that you can actually spot was used quite heavily because the way it's kind of dug in, you can see where the cattle went through there, and it was used as a night watch. So when you brought these cattle in at night, they had to be watched. So it was a 2-hour guard. It'd leave two or three cowboys up. The cattle would eat for 3 or 4 hours and maybe lay down, drink water, go to sleep. But there were always two or three cowboys that were riding around. They'd ride around in 2-hour shifts. They'd go back, go to sleep. Two or three other cowboys would get up, ride around. This was a tough job.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that there's an obelisk at the Cowboy Hall of Fame in Medora. How will you mark the trail, and how often will these markers be, and what will they indicate? Will there be a little history with them?
All right, here it goes. First of all, this never would have gotten off the ground had it not been for Dickinson Ready Mix out in Dickinson, North Dakota. After I agreed to this, I went in to Dickinson Ready Mix, and I was kind of begging a little bit for maybe would you make five of these obelisks? They're 7 feet high. They weigh about 250 pounds. They're about 6 inches square, maybe a little bigger than that. And they say they're white, and they say in red letters on them, Great Western Trail. And Scott O'Lean, whose father I knew, he was a legislator from Dickinson, so I knew him for a number of years. Scott O'Lean runs and owns Dickinson Ready Mix. And he turns out the guy's a real history buff. So I showed him all the information I had and told him what we were going to do, and he took one look at it and he said, "Well, how many do you need to go from Canada to or from the South Dakota line up to Canada?" I said, "Well, about 50, because we're going to put them every 6 miles." And he said, "Okay, we'll do that for you." And I said, "Really? I mean, how much?" And he, "Well, there's no charge on this. And we always get trucks that come in at night with concrete. You get us some forms and we'll do them." And Dickinson Ready Mix did this for us. They made the 7 foot long obelisks and actually painted them for us too. I mean, an incredible sacrifice on their part, and it was a gift that's worth thousands of dollars. So that gave us a real head start. So every 6 miles, and maybe in some cases, depending upon the view, it might be four or maybe seven, and they're right alongside the highway. They're not in the right of way. They are in ranchers' lands. You can see them. And then we have marble plaques that we put up. We put up one on the North Dakota South Dakota border. The state highway department gave us permission. We put one right up on the courthouse lawn, Slope County in Abingdon, North Dakota, because it sits right next to the highway, and it goes with an obelisk. We have another one in Belfield. There'll be one that's going in Grassy Butte, one in Watford City, probably a couple near the Williston area. And they weigh about 450 pounds. And Dickinson Ready Mix is actually moving these for us and putting them in the right spot. We get a group of ranchers together. talk to them, spend time. They're all fired up about it because it's their livelihood, it's their history, and it's an opportunity to make a contribution towards history. And so about every 6 miles, 250 pounds, and Doug, I put your name on the list. So we got about 150 miles left to go, but we'll make it. Run we're going to make on this is from Belfield to Watford City, and tentatively we were set to go September 27th, which is a Sunday afternoon. Takes about a day and a half, and the ranchers get two of them. They bring out their Melro Bobcats with a drill on the front, and others bring their pickups, and we put the obelisks in the back. We drive to the holes that we picked out and drill that hole and tamp that in and put quickcrete in there, pour some water in, and we go on to the next one.
Wow. So you've got Dickinson Ready Mix. You've got a lot of sweat equity and volunteers. How about what's left to fund here? How is this project being funded?
Well, nobody is making a nickel on this project. Okay. No one is making a nickel. It's being funded, actually by a group, a service club, Rotary International, has picked this up. And Sylvia Mohaney down in Texas is a big backer of this, and she's been pushing this project for about 10 years and kept it going, and she's big in Rotary. And the Rotarians have picked this project up, and all along the trail, they are providing some funding and a lot of help and that kind of thing. So we got money from Bowman's Travel Fund, and also the Rotary Club in Bowman was very generous. We're getting the Dickinson Rotary Club taking care of the books. The last thing I wanted to do was start another 501c3, because then you got to have an accountant. So they're doing the books, and I suspect they're going to come through with a sizable contribution. We're hoping, of course, that Williston and Watford City will also come through with sizable contributions. We need about another $7,000-$8,000 just to handle expenses to finish it, and we'll get it done.
Well, Rotary is an international service club, and I suspect the idea that it's connecting Mexico and Canada through the U.S. is attractive to the clubs. When do you expect it to be completed?
Well, we'd like to complete the Belfield-Watford City route the end of September this year. And then next spring, we would make the Watford City to via the Williston and then over to Fort Buford run. Take us about another day and a half to do that one. And of course, Fort Buford, very historic site. And that's where it basically ended in North Dakota, and the distributions were made.
We have another tourist attraction on its way in North Dakota. Daryl Dorgan is the project manager for the Great Western Trail Project in North Dakota, and I assume part of South Dakota, too. Daryl, thanks very much for joining us today.
Always fun to talk to you guys. You take care. End of September, you want it, you come out and grab a spade. We'll put a smile on your face, okay?
Thank you, Daryl.
See ya.
Tom Ezern is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Benedictine Health System, helping seniors live fully with independent housing, assisted living, long-term care, and rehab services in North Dakota and Minnesota. BHSHealth.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. As we drive around the state we call home, it's interesting to note how our presence has changed the appearance of the land. It's not just farms and towns. It's also trees. Last week, historian Tom Ezern shared a Plainsfolk essay about a storied place, now gone, called Taylor's Grove. Today, his essay returns to the groves planted generations ago.
The groves of trees planted by settlers to meet the requirements of the Timber Culture Act of 1873 did not fulfill the hopes of those who figured that tree planting would modify the climate of the Great Plains. They did, however, have a positive effect on the cultural environment of the prairies. The groves became named landmarks and the summertime sites for all sorts of community activities. They were essential features of the settlement landscape. Where to have the end of school term exercises, the Sunday school picnic, a political rally, a religious revival, a gathering of old settlers or lodge brothers or a big family, a baseball game, a 4th of July celebration. Go to the Grove. And the Grove had a name. In just Dickey County, using newspaper references, I have identified Taylor's Grove, Puffer Grove, Olmsted's Grove, Maddock Grove, Hoyback's Grove, Allen's Grove, Gebhart Grove, Nels Hansen Grove, Willow Grove, Wagner's Grove, Sweet Grove, August Larson's Grove, Farrell's Grove, Brown's Grove, Adamson's Grove, Rasmussen Grove, Stokes Grove, Skaggs Grove, Anderson's Grove, Streeter Grove, and Allen, A-L-I-N, Grove. And I have researched this only casually so far. These sites can be located on the ground following identification in the Bureau of Land Management Patent Index. Are any of these old groves, dating perhaps from the 1880s, still standing? A week or so ago, I recounted my search for Taylor's Grove near Menango, which turns out to be a ghost grove. From there, however, I headed down the Jim River to Ludden in search of Allen's Grove, a storied stand of trees. The planter of the grove in the 1880s and successful timber claimant in 1895 was William B. Allen, an interesting character about whom little is known, despite the fact he served in North Dakota's first legislature and as Speaker of the House. He was a land capitalist in several states, who for a few years called Ludden home. His timber claim, along the river, southwest of town, was one of his many properties. Community activities at Allen's Grove commenced in 1894 with a farmer's harvest picnic and a church service in August. Then on September 20th, convened a political debate with Republican former Governor John Miller taking on Reverend W.E. Gifford, speaking for the populists, and Reverend D.C. Planette, speaking for the prohibitionists. Of the many events celebrated at Allen's Grove during succeeding decades, the most celebrated was the baseball game, matching clubs from Oaks and Hecla, on the 21st of June, 1895. This was written up in the Oaks Weekly Republican and illustrated with multiple line drawings, or I should say caricatures, of the players, such as the one captioned, "Brown takes a lead off." With one foot on first base, the other planted halfway to second, the distance spanned by his rubberized legs. Oaks won, 8-1. A recurring event at Allen's Grove was the annual Hoosier Picnic, a gathering of old settlers from Indiana for a family picnic lunch. And I found the grove. At first, driving the section lines and lanes, I did not espy it. But then, a young farmer parked his rig by my pickup, and in the course of our conversation shouted over the engine noise of his tractor, indicated where I should look. The old grove had been screened from my view by more recent green ash shelter belts, but there it was. About 50 aged cottonwoods, some 90 feet high, some 4 feet in diameter, with an understory of box elder, all laid out in a horseshoe opening to the east. My mind's eye saw the enclosure as a field of dreams, wherein the uniformed boys from Oaks and Hecla contended.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, a preview of tonight's PBS special, COVID's Hidden Toll, and we'll check in with horticulturist Ron Smith. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota lawmakers have ended their second special session of the year early this morning when the House failed to get a 3/5 vote on a bonding bill. The bill was a $1.8 billion plan for public works borrowing. Republicans opposed it after holding out for a bill that would reduce some of Governor Tim Walz's emergency coronavirus powers. Republican Representative Jim Nash of Waconia says the majority Democrats should have done more to consult with the GOP on the makeup of the projects.
And include us, not just pat us on the head like we're some kid at the Thanksgiving child's table. you know what, we'll work with you.
There's a chance the bonding bill could resume in another special session, possibly in August. The University of Jamestown is planning to renovate Taylor Stadium. It's an $11 million project. University Vice President for Development and Alumni Relations Brett Moser says the campaign will be a joint venture between the university and Jamestown Public School District.
The aim of this project is to upgrade one of the most historic and beautiful settings for football and track in the Upper Midwest. Included in this project will be a new competition track, new field event upgrades to be located within the stadium, and a new throwing area adjacent to the stadium.
Moser says $4.6 million has been raised by the University of Jamestown, with a $2 million contribution coming from the Jamestown Public School District. University President Dr. Polly Peterson says there have been a number of discussions in previous years for the university and school district to partner. She says an already strong working relationship with the district is a big reason this project will work.
There are many reasons why it would be beneficial for us, I suppose, to each have our own facilities. But in days like now, it's never been more important to steward our resources wisely. And together, we gain more than we could have done had we been working on our own.
The plan is to start work on the project in October and have Taylor Stadium ready for the start of the 2021 football season. And residents from 31 states, including North Dakota, must now quarantine for 14 days when arriving in New York, as dozens of states face rising positive COVID-19 rates. Governor Andrew Cuomo acknowledged that the quarantine is, quote, imperfect, but said the quarantine could help protect the state against the risk of increased spread. Minnesota was recently dropped from New York's quarantine list after the state questioned the order. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tonight's Frontline on PBS explores how the COVID crisis has hit vulnerable immigrants and undocumented workers especially hard. Today we'll share a preview of the subject as Jackie Hendry of South Dakota Public Broadcasting interviews filmmaker Daffodil Altan in an excerpt from In the Moment.
This population featured in this film, you're no stranger to covering these workers. How long have you been covering this community?
I'd say probably, you know, over a decade now. So it's been, I think one of the things that's different this time is that normally, because this is a very sensitive community, the community that I also know well because of my own background, is that it takes a lot of time to gain access just to have a conversation, much less getting someone to agree to go on national television. So the challenge this time was that we had very little time to do that. So, but yeah, I've been doing this for, we've looked at labor trafficking in the agricultural community. We've looked at sexual assault in the agricultural industry over the years. So it's been a long time and a lot of exploitation that we've looked at.
Mm-hmm. At least one person, perhaps more of the people featured in this work through Frontline, you've talked to for some of those other pieces that you just mentioned. Tell us what you knew about their lives before the virus and then how that played in once the pandemic started breaking out, well, how the wheels started turning for you on the next piece of that story.
Yeah, I'm based in California, and when shelter in place went into effect, we were the first state in the country to shelter in place. And so my co-producer and I and other colleagues who had worked on these films and the agricultural community over the past years started thinking, what is this going to mean once we were divided between those who could shelter in place and the new category of essential workers, the essential businesses, and who they were. And I think what rose to the top and what we were all focused on with, which was understandable, was the essential healthcare workers and what was going on and the lack of protective equipment and the crisis that really the essential healthcare workers were facing. But parallel to that crisis, which we were starting to think about and were then starting to hear about from some of our sources from our prior work, was what was going on and possibly what could get worse in the agricultural industry. So we started hearing about, well, we really have no protective equipment out here and no one is thinking about us at all. We are working in meatpacking and there is no separation. There's not even a conversation around what needs to happen around COVID-19. So our alarm bells started going off thinking about, wait, when we were sheltering in place here in California, all you could do was be at home. I was one of the lucky ones who could work from home and then go get food. And, you know, you started seeing things being pulled off the shelves and people started talking about, will there be a food shortage? And so for us, that question became, will there be a food shortage? And also, what will this mean for the workers who are actually doing this work right now, who are doing it in very vulnerable and precarious situations and who have no protection? So we decided to start following what would be the harvest in California. And workers that we've known over the past years, one of them who's in the film, her name is Mari Cruz. She was in our film 7 years ago, Rape in the Fields, and we were speaking with her, and she was in Arizona preparing to make her way back to California. And she was telling us a lot of the California residents who are longtime farm workers but who move around the state and into Arizona are preparing for the harvest in California, and so there will be a lot of movement. And what will this mean? What will this look like as this is overlapping with a rise in infections across the country?
One of the other workers you spoke with, a couple of them would only speak to you on the condition of remaining anonymous out of fear of losing their job. And one of those people compares the working conditions that they were facing to slavery. Talk to us about what leads him to that conclusion.
I think one of the challenges for many of the essential workers in multiple industries, and here we were looking specifically at agriculture, is to have suddenly been deemed critical and essential. You did not have the choice to stop working. You had to keep working, and you were elevated to this very important status. You were essential to the nation's food supply. But at your own workplace, you were not treated as essential per se. You were not given anything additional to protect yourself. You were not given a plan or a protocol for how this was going to play out, when really you and, you know, for the sake of your family, just like all of us were feeling, you also wanted to stay home, but you knew that you couldn't. You had to keep working because you were deemed essential, and you had to keep working, frankly, because these are low-wage industries. So people also didn't have the choice. In order to keep eating themselves, they had to keep working. And so I think what we were finding, what's been so challenging, and in the situation where you're hearing from this worker who said he feels like a slave, is because he and his coworkers, other coworkers that we talked to, wanted to be treated as if they were essential by being given the essentials that they need to feel protected and safe at work. And so that included PPE, that included knowing what was going to happen at their work site during a potential outbreak, during an infection. Because what happens, as you see in the film, is when the outbreak hits at their work site, they're met with denials. People are called out for wearing face masks initially. They're sent home because they're scaring other workers. So they were almost getting a counter message to what was going on, swirling around them as the entire state was sheltering in place. It was just, you know, it created so much anxiety, so much stress, because you didn't know every day what you were walking into.
One of the sites featured in this documentary, they didn't take any precautions until that local TV station ran a news story about the outbreak at that facility. And also, works like this frontline piece are often the only way people around the country even are aware about the issues facing these people are facing. How does a time like this impact the way that you see your job as a journalist?
That's a good question. You know, when we went into shelter in place, and I have, you know, an elderly mother, I have small children, I wanted also to stay home and protect ourselves. And I think what was different this time for me as a journalist is that usually you are working on telling a story, you're revealing something that hasn't been told, you're helping to tell someone else's story. But in this situation, as I was engaging with the subjects, with everyone in the film that was going to put themselves on the line and participate in the film, we were all also in a shared COVID situation. Yeah. We all had to have conversations, shoot in a different way, be outside, bring protective equipment, because we had to be mindful of our movement as journalists and interviewing different people and not becoming vectors. Because as we were preparing to do this and following the harvest and following the story, we also had to be very mindful of our own potential risk, the exposure that we were subjecting people to. So there was a lot. There was a lot going on, you know, in the psychological sort of mental sidelines as you're trying to do the work you usually do, but you're also yourself terrified. You're also trying to be mindful of not infecting the people whose stories you're trying to tell. You're trying to be mindful of how to properly capture something that's watchable, because I think, you know, we've been watching a lot of Zoom interviews and we wanted to, the story to feel as palpable and as real as it felt for us when we were engaging with, you know, the subjects in the film. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think I felt both a deep desire as a human being to stay home. But as a journalist, I felt compelled. I had a responsibility in this moment to tell this story that you know, wasn't being told and that needed telling, because, again, while a lot of us have been able to shelter in place, the essential workers have never stopped working. They have not stopped this entire time. And so, you know, I think once I was going out there and shooting and producing and basically working and taking protocols and taking PPE, you know, what dawned on me that was, which made this even more important to tell, is that I got to stop. I would go out for a few days and come back home and quarantine, et cetera. But the workers we were speaking with and whose stories we were telling, they never stopped. They had to keep going. They had to keep sort of managing that daily risk, that daily anxiety, that daily fear of not knowing if they were going to come home that evening be infected with COVID-19.
How do you balance those very human feelings as you're, you know, you're doing your work as best you can, but also managing that fear that everyone is feeling?
I think a lot of it had to do once we started engaging with the subjects in the film and just observing the courage that they have and that the non-choice that they have. You know, there's what fuels a lot of this work and a lot of the work that a lot of us journalists do is just documenting what's happening in a moment. And this is a historical moment. There's someone in our film who says this is a once in a century pandemic. And so it becomes important to pay attention and to document something that may otherwise not be documented or told. And so as we were speaking with, as we were engaging with the subjects in the film, you know, really, one of the subjects in our film is a farm worker who herself has cancer and is daily going out to pick broccoli. And her life, she has children. She has an elderly mother. She has, you know, disabled siblings. And she is responsible for all of them. And so when I looked at her situation and my situation, I felt, again, a responsibility to help her tell her story because her situation is so precarious, and it doesn't need to be so precarious.
That was filmmaker Daffodil Altan speaking with South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Jackie Hendry for In the Moment. COVID's Hidden Toll premieres tonight at 9 Central on our television service. Horticulturist Ron Smith is next.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
In his teen years, lots of people were saying they expected Bill Clinton to be president someday.
They hated his guts, and they would go to the end of the earth to destroy him.
What a squandering of talent and possibility.
Tonight has made Bill Clinton the comeback kid.
A definitive look at the man and the president. Clinton on American Experience.
Watch American Experience tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Ashley Thornburg and horticulturist Ron Smith. It's time to talk about gardens and lawns and all kinds of growing stuff.
Ron, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
You can always reach out to Ron through us by emailing mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. And Ron, we've had a lot of tremendous heat and then a little bit of moisture. And all of a sudden I walk out in my backyard and I kind of want to sing the Jurassic Park theme song. Mm. Like, plants really came up tall.
Oh, yeah. They love the rain. And so do the mosquitoes. I went out in my backyard this morning and got driven back in by Good grief, a swarm of mosquitoes. You'd think I was living near a swamp. But then my wife goes out later on this morning and she says she wasn't even bothered. And usually she goes out with a mosquito hat on. So the rains can do a good job of reinvigorating lawns that are mowed too short. A lot of people keep their lawn mowing it to a short height, even through the summer months, and it results in a quick burnout or quick movement into dormancy for the crown of the plant. But, you know, you get a rain like this, and it just literally greens up grass that's on the verge of dormancy overnight to a beautiful verdant color. So one of the things I'd like to bring up is what I would call garden bullies. You know, you need to watch out for some of the things you wish for in your garden, like mint, for example, to go ahead and pick occasionally mint leaves to put into a salad or to make mint tea with. You will have more mint if you're not careful than you can possibly convert into any kind of a drink that you would be able to keep up with.
I have an explosion of lemon balm. I'm trying to figure out how to power my house with lemon balm at this point.
Yeah. It's quite the plant. So you need to be careful of that. And the rest of the summer would be a good time to go ahead and get this taken care of so you don't have it coming back next year. If you've never dug mint out, be prepared to have your back worked on by a chiropractor afterwards, because it has a very extensive root system that has it creeping all over the place, and it'll bully out other plants as well. Another good one to watch out for are goutweed, very inappropriately called because it has nothing absolutely to do with gout, but it's somewhat of an attractive looking plant planted underneath the canopy of trees. It has a white and green variegation to its foliage, and it looks very innocent and lovely at first, but then letting it go one summer, then another summer, then another summer, and before you know it, you have it taking over everything. And also violets, be careful of violets. If you like violets, and they are beautiful, they have a tendency, though, to bully those things out. A good battle between, you know, a good Darwinism battle would be to plant goutweed and violets adjacent to each other and see who wins given minimal care. So anyway, just some things to go ahead and watch out for. And one more, a couple more, because people have asked me about it. Lily of the Valley, if it gets a chance to get established in your garden, will take over, and it makes a very, very difficult plant to dig out along with horseradish. Now, if you're back into the 1950s and early 60s Cold War of making your own bomb shelter and you want to put a good, strong roof over your bomb shelter being dug in the ground, Lily of the Valley and horseradish would certainly make a good addition to that because it'll give it a lot of protection. But if you have something you have to dig out, make sure you get a young back or two to help you dig that out.
Ron, we've had plenty of rain in this part of the state. We're above average, I think, for this time of year right now. And, of course, we've had this hot weather and all that. I've been watching my red twig dogwood squeak out of the ground literally before my eyes. Is this a good time to prune it back?
Yes, you very nicely moved me into my next comments. This is the time to shape your woody plants the way you want them. Small trees, red twig dogwood, Diablo woody plant, shrubs, hibiscus, hydrangeas, whatever. Go around your yard and shape them the way you want. Now, you might say, well, how do you do that? Well, if you mow your yard and you have branches getting in the way, that's the branch that's got to come off somewhere, somehow, to allow you to mow under it, because you don't want to get continually poked in the head by a branch that you're going by. And if you have shrubs along the border, you need to be aware that those shrubs on your border, planted on your border of the property, will have a tendency to branch over into your neighbors. And hopefully you have good relationships with your neighbors. If you say, look, I'll keep the shrubs, the hedge from getting into your yard too much to interfere with your mowing or the pleasure of your yard, there, why I'll come over and take care of it for you. If not, then no, they say, no, I'll take care of it on my side of the property. That's fine. They can do whatever they want to it on that side of their property. But yes, this is a perfect time to go ahead and do that type of pruning. Whatever you do, don't get ladders out and start climbing up into your trees to try to be a heroic Tarzan type tree pruner. None of us, unless you are doing that on a regular day-to-day basis, should be doing anything along those lines. Even if you're young and nimble like Ashley is, she could get into trouble climbing a tree herself. Anyway, hire a professional arborist to come out and do that type of trimming. Let's see. Oh, yes, another good one here to address would be I've gotten some photos of leaves covered with little blisters on the underside of the leaves. Those are responsive growths, so they're not going to cause any problem. They're almost like little freckles on the leaves caused by a midge. And you see them on maples. You see them on elm trees. You see them on ash trees. Just something to go ahead and take a look at. It's not causing any problems with the trees. And if you see a couple of caterpillars chewing on your branches, not to worry about it too much, because most trees can tolerate a 50% reduction in their leaf mass and recover, assuming they're healthy trees going into that reduction in leaf mass. People often ask, what should I spray with? Nothing. You don't spray with anything. You don't want to spray trees with anything that you have to put up over your head. Simply let nature take its course, and they will have a tendency to disappear in subsequent years or become less destructive as the time goes by.
Just very quickly, Ron, I know early in the year you want to do things like cut the suckers off of tomatoes, or you want to pinch mm-hmm. your apple blossoms to try to increase the fruit set there, having fewer but bigger. Is there anything right now to do for soon-to-be harvested fruits and veggies?
Well, you know, apple fruit trees have already set their fruit. And you want to take a look at the way the branches are supported, because with the winds that we have here, and not even storm winds, but nice sunny day winds, can have a tendency to whip the ends of the branches around. And you get the effect of having a weight at the end of a floppy branch, and you could have that branch be ripped off or weakened in some way that it would rip off at some near future date. So if you have a lot of apples at the end of branches, or just a couple of big apples at the end of branches, you might want to come up with some kind of a clothes pole or netting or roping support to give them to keep them from, you know, being thrown all over the place and having them cause the branches to break. So that's something you want to try to keep in mind. Also, be aware that as we get it further into the summer, things that start to ripen get the attention of yellow jackets, and you might see a beautiful apple up in your tree. It looks nice and red. And you reach up with your bare hand to pick it, and you find three or four yellow jackets on the other side of it feeding away. So you want to be aware of that. Nobody enjoys being attacked by these members of the wasp family, and they seem to get more and more aggressive as we get further into the summer and early fall months. And speaking of fall, autumn is just 63 days away from today. So it's... That's almost around the corner for us here in North Dakota, because after that, anything can happen as far as the weather goes.
Well, we'll have to leave it with that, but we check in with horticulturist Ron Smith regularly during the growing season. Thanks, Ron.
You're welcome, and my pleasure.
Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 21st. On this date in 1962, Pheasants Unlimited announced the release of 750 pheasants south of Bismarck. The organization sought to support and encourage pheasant hunting in the state. The release of the birds would replenish the population and attract hunters. Pheasants are only one of many birds hunted in North Dakota. Other game birds include ducks, geese, and turkeys. When it comes to bigger game, the state has bighorn sheep, elk, deer, and moose. The extremes of North Dakota climate can affect the wildlife. A harsh winter or a dry summer can decrease populations, but man-made improvements can help. The Department of Agriculture determined that the Conservation Reserve Program has had a positive effect. The program was established in 1985. It was intended to improve water quality, prevent soil erosion, and increase wildlife habitat. It's administered by the Farm Services Agency. In exchange for a yearly rental payment, farmers agree to remove environmentally sensitive land from production. Farmers plant species that will improve environmental health and quality. The farmers can also enroll in a program that opens the land to hunters. They receive an initial payment per acre for the conservation efforts, plus annual payment for the hunting. As of 2015, there were almost 15,000 participants in the program, receiving $70 million. Hunting is big business for North Dakota. The hunters and fishermen purchase licenses that support the Game and Fish Department. They also pay taxes when they purchase equipment like ammunition and fishing tackle. This money also goes to the Game and Fish Department. Hunting and fishing have an enormous impact on North Dakota's economy. Sportsmen rent hotel rooms, buy gas, eat in local restaurants, and purchase supplies. Non-resident hunters bring millions of dollars into the state. Consequently, it's realized that the investment in conservation has a positive impact on the state's bottom line. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In an effort to improve testing and speed up results, the FDA is looking at a new kind of test for COVID-19.
Now to bring people back to work, and how do you bring kids back to school? Our teachers be safe? This is the kind of test you need.
But could an inexpensive test you take at home help control the pandemic, even if it's not precise? The possibility of rapid testing on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street on Prairie Public. And as I always remind you, as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, a recent Dakota Datebook on the religious sect called the Dukhobors attracted the ire of some listeners. The original 1908 article in the Hope Pioneer that the Datebook was based on carried the headline Armed Fanatics, but it turns out they weren't Dukhobors. So we'll feature Jonathan Kalmakoff, who's studied Dukhobor history, and Professor Ashley Androsoff of the University of Saskatchewan, who specializes in the history of Western Canada. That's coming up on Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.